The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. My guest this week likes a good scare. As a kid, Sam Irvin loved Bride of Frankenstein, and he brought that influence with him as an adult when he directed the show Dante's Cove and the movie Elvira's Haunted Hills, among many other projects. Whether he's working with Christopher Lee, Brian De Palma, or Ian McKellen, Sam is an endless source of amazing showbiz stories, and I'm so glad to bring them to you on this episode. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook, where I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. This week I'll be posting clips from The Bride of Frankenstein, Dante's Cove, and Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly live stream on September 19th at 11 a.m. Pacific, a nice relaxing time to just hang out and chat. There's a link to that at the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And don't forget to check out my other shows. Culture Cruise on YouTube is a deep dive into queer entertainment milestones. My most recent one is about the show Living Single. And check out Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two narrative comedy shows with drag heroes going on adventures in a world of fantasy. Now, here's Sam. Well, this week I'm speaking with Sam Irvin, director, producer, and author. He's the director of Elvira Haunted Hills, the producer of Gods and Monsters, author of a book about Kay Thompson. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Matt. Thank you for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Bride of Frankenstein, which is my all-time favorite film to this very day. And I saw it as a kid on TV. We had Shock Theater on Saturday afternoons that showed all the great Universal classics. That movie just spoke to me in a way that it was just hard to even define. And I later, of course, learned as I grew up that it was directed by a gay director named James Whale, and that there was all sorts of gay subtext to the movie, which apparently was screaming out to me as a kid, but I didn't really quite understand why until many years later. And of course, I'm sure all of your listeners have discussed the outsider theory and how gay people sort of identify with outsider characters. And certainly the Frankenstein monster was that in spades. I mean, here I am, a young gay kid and closeted, of course, you know, not really knowing what to do with that. And here's this monster who's a freak of nature, misunderstood by society and persecuted and abandoned by his creator and or father figure, if you want to call it that. And just so many of those things, you know, just really resonated with me. And I, you know, came to realize why in my adulthood, as I studied those films and learned more about the creator of the film, James Whale. And he also directed the original Frankenstein, which I love so much as well. But just the Frankenstein character always, I found him to not be a monster, and that he was so sympathetic, and he had no, you know, he turned out the way he did by no fault of his own, sort of thing. And yet he was constantly misunderstood. And I just loved that story so much.
I think people are really familiar with the famous Bride of Frankenstein look of like the wiggly white line through the giant, like, teased up hair. But for someone who's unfamiliar with Bride of Frankenstein, like, what is there? Like, what's the heart of that movie?
Well, the heart of the movie is that the monster is looking for love, and he is basically, in the first film, abandoned. And in the second film, this very effeminate doctor comes calling on Dr. Frankenstein and blackmails him in, his character name is Dr. Pretorius, and he was considered one of the first gay characters in mainstream cinema, played by a gay actor named Ernest Thesiger. And he comes and blackmails the doctor into creating a female mate for the creature. And so they embark on piecing together the female creature and bringing her to life. Well, of course, when she comes to life, she's not at all interested in the Frankenstein monster because he's not terribly attractive, and she's much more interested in the doctor. Well, this enrages the monster, who feels rejected all over again, and then, you know, basically commits suicide and brings down the castle on top of everyone. They had to do a little bit of a Hollywood ending. It wasn't originally how it was shot, but they added a little ending where the Dr. Frankenstein and his real bride and get away. So it kind of has a little bit of a happy ending for them. And yet, in fact, in my opinion, Dr. Frankenstein is, you know, the villain of the two movies. So it's all kind of interesting to me how Hollywood, you know, forced this upon James Whale to create this sort of quasi happy ending, which is kind of silly. And actually,
how old were you when you discovered the film?
Probably 6, 7, 8 years old, something like that.
When you first saw it, like, what was appealing to you? Like, as a 6 or 7, 8 year old, I'm sure you're not thinking like, ah, this is a metaphor for queer love. Like, what was exciting about it to you then?
It was just so astonishing. The visuals and the creature and the makeup and the bride with her teased out hair and this very weird character, this gay Dr. Pretorius. When he comes, he shows the doctor his previous experiments, and he's grown these miniature people in petri jars, and he brings them out and shows them, and there's all the special effects of these little tiny people, and oh my God, it was just eye-popping in every single way. I'd never seen, and I grew up, I'd seen a lot of films. My father owned movie theaters. My parents were very open to pretty much letting me see anything and everything, not only at the theaters, but on television. So I wasn't totally naive, but this was something that I just hadn't seen all of these things before, and I was just absolutely blown away. And then had to see, you know, when I realized that it was a sequel, I had to find the original film, wait for it to come on TV, and then see all the sequels after that, Son of Frankenstein and Ghost of Frankenstein, all the others that came after that at Universal. And then, like, there was also Dracula. Dracula never did it for me as much. I loved those films as well. But it was always the Frankenstein. If there was a Frankenstein movie coming on, I had to see it. It was just this unexplainable attraction for me from the very beginning.
Now, you said that your family owned movie theaters. So I'm going to assume that motion pictures were just a big part of your life.
Very much so, yes. I was, it was my playground. I had two older sisters, and when they would babysit me, they'd take me down to the movie theater. It was one of those old, great vaudeville palaces that had been turned into a movie theater, you know, standalone with, you know, 1500 seats. And it was just an incredible playground. If you've ever seen the movie Cinema Paradiso, where the little boy hangs out at the movie theater all the time and goes up the projection booth. And I mean, that was my life totally. And this was back in the days. I mean, I was born in 1956. So when I was 6 years old, pretty much, that's about as far back as I really start remembering things. It was like 1962-ish. And in those days, there's no videotape. There's no anything. You can't own movies or show movies in your home. You know, but I could go to the movie theater and watch movies as many times as I wanted. And it was just a real charmed childhood in that way.
Did you always want to be a creator of media? I mean, it's what you do now, but were you a creative kid?
Well, when in 1964, I was 8 years old, and my family took I grew up in North Carolina in Asheville, and we took a cross-country road trip to California to go to Disneyland and the Grand Canyon and do all the sights. Because of my dad's connections in the movie business, he got us a VIP tour at Warner Brothers Studios in Burbank. And I walked on to the set of Blake Edwards' The Great Race, where I saw Natalie Wood, Jack Lemmon, and Tony Curtis on an iceberg in this gigantic tank of water. And on the iceberg were antique cars, and there were wind machines and wave machines and fans blowing and just rain machines. It was unbelievable. And this is in a soundstage, and the eyes just popped right out of my head. I thought up until then, if they were going to shoot an iceberg storm scene, they'd have to go up to the North Pole and wait for a storm. You know, I just had no clue that this kind of thing was actually created on a stage. And Then they took me to see another little sequence that they were doing with a model of a mansion up on a hilltop. And this was on the soundstage. And the model couldn't have been not any higher than maybe 4.5-5 feet, because I actually saw men working on the roof of the model, like adjusting the chimney or whatever. And you could, they were a little bit taller than this model. And they would come down the hill, and at the bottom of the hill in front of this model house was a full-size gate and a full-size sidewalk. And they had an actor dressed as a policeman who was going to go walking by the sidewalk. And I was like, what? This isn't going to look right. It's going to look like somebody's walking by a model of a house up on the hill. Well, when I saw the film, it totally sold, and it's what's called forced perspective, where it's an effect and a visual that just works on camera, where you if you're standing there in real life, it doesn't sell, but on film it sold that was a full-size house up on the hillside. And they blew up the reason they were even creating a model is they had to have an explosion happen in one of the wings of the house. And so I got to watch them do that again, eyes popping out of my head. And then we went to another stage where they were shooting a film called Two on a Guillotine, which was a horror movie with Connie Stevens, Dean Jones, Cesar Romero, and it was directed by William Conrad, who went on to be an actor of Canon, the Canon series. And I watched them do a rear screen projection scene where Dean Jones and Connie Stevens are sitting in this ride at an amusement park, and they're in this sort of bullet bubble sort of capsule that's been sliced in half, where you just see them sitting there, and out the window behind them is rear screen projection of them flying around in this amusement park. And I got to even sit up in the set part of it, and a studio photographer has a picture of me there as a kid. And all of these things, by the end of the day, I was like, I want to do nothing more in this world than to direct movies. And my dad had an 8mm home movie camera, and I just took it out of his hands and never gave it back. And when we got back home, I was making little 8mm films with my young brother playing Dracula with a black beach towel as a cape and, lots of ketchup for blood. And, it was just that was my life from then on. That's all I wanted to do was direct movies. And teachers hated me at school because every time they had we have an open project. What do you want to write about? What do you want to do? And then for me, it was always about movies, 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 movies. And they couldn't get me to focus on anything but that.
What kind of movies did you make?
Mostly horror films. I was, Dracula. I did, later on, I did, a Dr. Fives thing. I did a voodoo doll thing. I did, and oddly enough, I wasn't making Frankenstein, even though they were my favorite movies. I'm not sure why. Maybe it was that I couldn't do the makeup or, that kind of thing and make it look as good. But it was always horror. That was my thing growing up, for sure.
What was the appeal of horror for you? Was it the scare, or was there something else to it?
I think it was the scare. I mean, I love going on the thrill ride of being spooked. I mean, I remember one of the first times my parents left me at home alone, probably, 6, 7-ish, somewhere in there. I was watching Shock Theater in the Saturday afternoon, and they just went over to a friend's house in the neighborhood, and they were going to be gone for an hour or two. And I said, oh, I'll be fine. I have to see this movie. So they let me stay and see the movie instead of going with them. And a storm came over, and lightning and everything. And it was a Frankenstein film. And I was so terrified. I was hiding behind the chair. I was worried that there was a big bay window. And I was worried that the monster was going to come up out of the woods. And, it was just one of those really seminal, scary things. And afterwards, I loved it. I loved having that experience of being so frightened.
When you started to do that more professionally, was that something that happened in college? Did you go to school for that? Or how did you get into the actual industry?
I did go to film school at the University of South Carolina. By the time I got there, I was kind of self-taught. So it was really kind of going through the motions because the other students in the class had not made films and I had made a bunch. So it was kind of just putting my time in school to get the diploma that would say that I'm a civilized person. You know, I was very bored in school, couldn't wait to get out. But, you know, my parents were like, you know, you have to graduate from college, you know, and sort of thing. So I did it. But I was making films. I was editing and publishing my own fanzine on horror films called Bizarre. The first couple of issues, I would just write to people like Vincent Price and Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing and all the horror stars of that era, and send them questions, and they would answer them and send it back, and I would print it in the magazine as an interview, and even though it was done through the mail with a questionnaire. And then when I graduated from high school, my parents said, what do you want for your graduation present? I said, I want to go to London so I can meet some of these people in person, because a lot of the films that I loved at that time were Hammer films, which were being made in England. And they were the Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing movies. Christopher Lee played Dracula in those versions, and they were done in color, and they were done starting in the late 50s through the 60s and 70s. So lo and behold, I was lucky. They sent me, and I wrote ahead, and they were all, you know, since I'd already interviewed these people by mail, you know, they kind of knew who I was and had seen my magazine. And so when I got there, I was able to, for instance, I went and had lunch with Christopher Lee at Pinewood Studios, where he was shooting a little film called The Man with the Golden Gun, which was the second Roger Moore James Bond movie, in which he played the villain and the man with the golden gun, actually. After lunch, I mean, I interviewed him with a little cassette tape recorder for my magazine. And then after lunch, he said, do you want a tour of the Bond sets and watch us shoot the rest of the day? And of course, and it was just this incredible experience. And I got to, you know, be on the set and watch Roger Moore and everybody doing, you know, there wasn't any chase scenes or shagging, but I got to see them do some scenes for a James Bond movie. It was the coolest freaking thing. And then at the end of the day, Christopher Lee said, do you want to ride in our chauffeured Rolls Royce back to London? And I'm like, sure. So I get in the car, and it's Christopher Lee and Hervé Villechaize, the little diminutive actor who played on Fantasy Island, Duplaine. Mm-hmm. He was playing Christopher Lee's sidekick in that movie, and was really the inspiration for Mini Me in the Austin Powers movies. And anyway, he was drunk as a skunk.
Of course.
Started telling us these crazy stories about all the prostitutes he'd hired since he'd been in London, and started describing it in graphic detail. And Christopher Lee, who normally you think of as just this very austere and serious man, started to crack up laughing, and he totally lost it, just doubled over. And I was laughing and just all the way back. And it was just the funniest thing to see what I thought of as Dracula, you know, just in hysterics over, you know, dirty talk.
That sounds amazing.
It's just crazy. And I'm only scratching the surface. I could go on for hours with just the craziest things that happened when I was in London.
I mean, I want to hear all about like what Christopher Lee is just like to hang out with.
Yeah. I mean, he was an incredibly nice guy. I asked him when we were touring the Bond set, and his character was Scaramanga, and we were going mm-hmm. through his lair, and there was an entire wall devoted to a butterfly collection, and I was behind glass, and these butterflies tacked up on the walls, and I'm like, are these butterflies real? And he goes, Sam, this is a James Bond movie, not a Hammer film. And he he had this sort of snobbery about the lower budgeted horror movies that uh-huh. he had done, and he always wanted to work on the A pictures with all the big directors and everything. And to his credit, he went on and did that. He worked with Spielberg in 1941. He worked with Scorsese and Hugo. He worked with Peter Jackson in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and he worked with Tim Burton and you know, just on and on and on, all these amazing, big, giant film productions. But the ironic thing, of course, is that all those filmmakers that I just named adored Christopher Lee because they grew up with him as Dracula in all the Hammer films.
Of course. So
without that as a stepping stone, he wouldn't have had an opportunity to be in all those great films.
So how did this inspire your own work? Like when you were done with film school and you're like, okay, now I've got a degree, or I don't know, maybe you didn't. Like, did you get all the way through film school, or what was your trajectory at that point?
Yeah, I went to film school, University of South Carolina. And while I was there, I, of course, Mr. Eager Beaver, I headed up the film committee and we had a movie theater on campus. And I was falling in love with the films of Brian De Palma. I was a big Hitchcock fan. And in those days, De Palma had done a film called Sisters, Siamese Twins, sort of a horror film. And he'd also done Phantom of the Paradise, which was a musical comedic adaptation, modernization of Phantom of the Opera with rock music. So I adored those films. And I managed to track him down in California by phone. He was casting Carrie. It was the most famous casting sessions in the history of cinema because he and George Lucas were reading Every Kid in Town together for Star Wars and for Carrie. So everybody that came in, you know, Carrie Fisher came in and read for Carrie and read for Princess Leia. And
was this at the same session?
Yes, the same sessions.
What?
They sat together behind a table at Zoetrope, the Francis Ford Coppola's company, and just literally brought in Every Kid in Town. So anyway, I got the phone number through the trade journals of the casting office and called, and lo and behold, they put Brian on the phone. And I explained that we were doing this little festival of his stuff at the University of South Carolina. Would he come for a visit? And he said, look, I'm broke. I live in New York. I need something at my apartment. If you can fly me from LA to South Carolina, then to New York, and then back to LA, I'll come for the Triangle airfare. And I said, done. So he came out, met him, and that led to the following summer. He was shooting The Fury, which was another telekinesis horror film, follow-up to Carrie, with Kirk Douglas and John Cassavetes, this incredible cast. And they were shooting in Chicago in the summer between my junior and senior year in college. And so I called up De Palma, and now I have his personal number. And I said, could I please come up and work on that? And he said, sure, come on up. You can be a production assistant. So I went up to Chicago, worked on that. I also was an extra in the film. And then I got an assignment from a horror sci-fi magazine called Cine Fantastique. By now, I had kind of given up doing my own fanzine because I was so busy with school and other things, but I had gotten to know people in that world. And this was a much slicker, you know, very professional magazine. And I got an assignment to do a journal on the making of The Fury. So I was sort of an official journalist on the set as well, which allowed me to have one-on-one interviews with you know, Kirk Douglas and John Cassavetes and the Amy Irving and everybody who worked on it. And so this was my education, much more than school was. You know, it was actually being on a film set, actually talking to my idols and all these incredible creators. And so, you know, that's how I educated myself. And then I went back to school for my senior year. And then De Palma called me just as I was graduating and said, listen, I'm going to do a low-budget film this summer called Home Movies. We're going to do it in New York. We're going to shoot it on the campus of Sarah Lawrence College. Do you want to come up and work on it? And I thought, well, first of all, I'm like, yeah. And secondly, I just assumed I would be a production assistant like I was on The Fury. And he told me the film was going to star Kirk Douglas again. And I already kind of knew Kirk a little bit from, you know, hanging out around The Fury. And he would know me. Nancy Allen was going to be in it, who was De Palma's girlfriend at that time, and she had been in Carrie. So this just sounded like unbelievable. And I had a job right after graduation on a real movie.
So what was that like?
I jumped on a plane, went up there. I get there and De Palma says, you know, oh, by the way, you're going to be the associate producer and production manager.
How old were you at this point?
So I was 22.
So, great.
So, you know, he, I guess, just saw that I was this go-getter, eager beaver, you know, super fan, groupie, he was going to throw me into the deep end to see if I could swim. And I did. And after that, he hired me as his full-time assistant. And I worked on Dress to Kill. I've got this great photo of me with Angie Dickinson and all bloodied in the elevator, the two of us standing there. And, you know, it was just, it was the most amazing education to be able to just be in De Palma's world at his side with him creating all through pre-production, where he would be storyboarding, when he would be casting, when he would be having meetings. I was there. You know, that's what I consider my college. So my professor was De Palma for sure.
Okay, and, so then you after you produce a Brian De Palma film at 22, imagine you've got an easier ticket to write in L.A.
A little bit. But I did a short film called Double Negative, and that got into Sundance, and it opened theatrically. And that became my calling card to get my first feature film off the ground as a director. And but it took a while. It was a few years. And then I directed a feature film called Guilty as Charged with Rod Steiger, who was a big Oscar winner. And it also had Heather Graham, Lauren Hutton, Isaac Hayes, who also was an Oscar winner. And that was a horror film. It was about a madman who kidnaps murderers and fries them in his own dungeon on his own electric chair. So I got to go crazy with all sorts of fabulous horror imagery with dungeons and German expressionistic lighting and everything. And it was just a dream come true.
Were you out at that point?
Well, I was out. I came out when I was 25. I was married to a woman for 6 years who I'd met in college. And I, you know, growing up in the South in those days, being gay was just not even really an option in my world. No role models, there were society and my parents and everything were just there. It just wasn't accepted at all. Not at all. Hmm. So, but once I got out of school, moved to New York, worked for De Palma, and was in an environment in New York City where there were loads of gay role models and a burgeoning gay community. I, you know, found my tribe. I knew I was attracted to men and everything, but I had sort of convinced myself that maybe I was bisexual and I could live the life that, you know, society and my parents wanted me to, but ultimately, no. And I met the love of my life in 1982, who I'm still with now, 38 years later.
How did you meet?
I met at a bar called The Cock Ring on Christopher Street in New York. I spotted him across the dance floor, and it was love at first sight. And boom, that was it. And we've been together ever since. And it was so... I came out, it was right after I quit working for De Palma I had produced a film that he had recommended I produce called The First Time, that was a comedy with Wendy Jo Sperber and Wallace Shawn, and directed by one of the writers of home movies. So it was kind of came out of the De Palma world. And we did that with New Line Cinema, but I didn't want to produce. That was, you know, that was the business side. And I wanted to direct. So after that is when I did my short film and really started working on, you know, getting my career going as a director.
Did you find yourself putting gay stuff, or maybe stuff that wasn't explicitly gay, but in hindsight, there was something going on? Did you find that like your sexuality worked its way into the creative work that you did?
As much as possible. It was very difficult since I wasn't writing the films that I was directing. They were it was pretty much already determined. The first feature film that I directed that I also wrote, it was for Showtime. It was a thriller called Kiss of a Stranger. And in that, I knew I couldn't get away with a lead gay character, but I had the main girl, played by Mariel Hemingway, had a gay best friend. And it was a very significant, supporting role. And that was in the late 90s. And so I would sneak it in as best I could on these, you know, very commercial films, many of which were being made for TV or, you know, whatever. And there were restrictions. So it wasn't until the late, it was actually right after that. I was one of the producers of Gods and Monsters, which was a very gay film. It starred Sir Ian McKellen, who of course is openly gay in real life, playing, guess who? James Whale, the gay director of Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein.
Now, it's such a coincidence that that is, was it like a formative film for you? How did, like, did you make that happen?
I did make it happen. I had read the book that it was based on by Christopher Bram, who's a wonderful gay author. And I tried to option it. I wanted to direct it. And he said, oh, I'm sorry, a guy named Bill Condon beat you to the punch. He just optioned it a couple weeks ago. So, and I had met Bill through Nancy Allen. He had directed her in a TV movie and he'd written one of her other films. And I'd met him at some of her parties. So I called up Bill and I said, listen, I'm such a huge fan of this book. I'm very jealous that you've gotten it to direct, but I want to do anything I can to help you. Have you thought about Ian McKellen playing the role? And he said, oh my God, we're on the same wavelength because I just sent Ian a copy of the book and I'm hoping that he's going to want to do it. And about a year goes by, Bill writes the script, which by the way, he later won the Oscar for adapting that script. Mm-hmm. I was at the same production company where I was making this Kiss of a Stranger with Muriel Hemingway. And I heard the name of the book. The book was actually called Father of Frankenstein. I heard them talking about the book in the hallway and I jumped up and I went out there and they said, yes, we've been submitted a script for this movie and Ian McKellen is attached. And I'm like, oh my God, this is fantastic. You have to do this movie. And I just badgered them and badgered them and badgered them until they ended up doing it. They were very nervous about it because it was quite gay. It was being made originally as a Showtime movie. It wasn't even going to be theatrically released. And but at any rate, long story short, it went, the contract with Showtime allowed it to go to film festivals. And if it were to get picked up for distribution, Showtime, if you paid Showtime a significant amount of money, they would allow it to be released theatrically first before it would show on Showtime. And that's essentially what happened. And then it became the award season darling and was, you know, winning all kinds of critics awards and was nominated for 3 Oscars and won the screenplay. And Lynn Redgrave won the Golden Globe for supporting actress. You know, it was, and Ian McKellen, of course, was not nominated everywhere. And for best actor, but it was just the most incredible film to work on. And on top of all of that, there's a flashback scene on the set of where James Whale is directing on the set of The Bride of Frankenstein in the big laboratory with the bride with her teased out hair. And we got to recreate that laboratory on a soundstage in Los Angeles. And we actually found the original electrical equipment that had been used in James Whale's Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. And we rented that.
Where was it?
It was created by Kenneth Strickfaden back in those days. And Mel Brooks had even found it and put it into Young Frankenstein.
Oh, wow. So, really?
Yeah. It is continued to appear in films over the years. So that was just, I mean, literally the hair on the back of my neck stood up when I stood on that set. And so working on that film was definitely, you know, a dream come true beyond all imagination. But I wasn't directing it. And Bill did an absolutely amazing job, better than I ever could have done. And I was just thrilled to be a part of it. But it wasn't my baby, you know, basically. And but this same production company ended up, they got bolder about gay subjects and they ended up starting their own gay network, a premium gay network by subscription. And it was called Here TV. And they did a series, a gay supernatural series, and I was hired to direct it. And I directed all 3 seasons of Dante's Cove. And that was, again, another incredible dream come true, because here's a horror series that's very gay, very sexy. I mean, when I say sexy, it was full frontal male nudity in every episode. It was a requirement of the network. And
was it really like they required there to be nudity?
Yes. Yes, and a lot of the lead actors wouldn't do full frontal, so we had to write in little bit parts where we could bring in, actors, sometimes from the adult film world or whatever it needed to be, to fulfill this mandate of having full frontal male nudity in every episode. But it was fantastic. We did the first season in the Caribbean and the second two seasons in Hawaii, and an excuse to have shirts off of boys at every turn, and it was great. It was really fun. It was like when I was growing up, I watched a soap opera called Dark Shadows, and it was kind of like a soap, like Dark Shadows, crossed with Queer as Folk.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what your inspirations were, like what sort of material you drew from and what your vision was, like how you wanted people to receive Dante's Cove.
In my mind, it was the first time, because even things like, there had been some gay series like Queer as Folk, but Queer as Folk was constantly touching on all the political LGBTQ issues of the day, whether it was AIDS or it was gay marriage or whatever. It was always, even though it was a soap opera and there was, the underlying storylines were always sort of pushing the agenda of whatever was going on at the time. And I felt like with Dante's Cove, look, I just want to do a freaking popcorn entertainment. I don't want to do all the political stuff. And what was great about the concept of the show was that took place on an island, Dante's Cove, and on this island were mostly gay people. And there was an occasional straight person, there were some lesbians, but it was mostly gay men. And so we already had the flip, the opposite of what the real world is in our little paradise. And it was sort of like, the straight people were the token straights and the gay people were the majority. And that was already, oh my God, this is going to be so much fun because the whole gay thing can be matter of fact. We don't have to deal with coming out stories, and we don't have to deal with just serious stuff. We can just do it very matter of fact. Everybody's gay, and that's it, and move on. And all the love stories and triangles were all about gay people, and it was just so much fun. And we could really focus on the horror elements and the let the storylines just be entertaining. And so that's what I felt we did. And I felt like it was influential in that right after that, suddenly there was Twilight, there was True Blood, there was all these other kind of shows that weren't quite as gay as ours were, but they all had a big gay element to it. And were very sexy and very much seemed to me like they were drawing upon, the well, the same well that we had sort of created.
Yeah, inserting that there's sort of a titillating quality to them that's not going too far to be like totally raunchy, but also the blending of and I'm sure this is I'm not the first person to observe that there is a parallel between stuff that's scary and stuff that's sexy.
Yes, exactly. So, that was just so much fun to do that. The same production company also let me do, they had for the Gay Network, because it was a very small audience and it was a subscription thing like HBO, but very, very small audience comparatively. So anything that they made for that network, had to be budgeted pretty low. And they came up with this idea, what if we a movie to Lifetime, but have enough gay content to have it for our gay network. And in those days, we're talking about, early, like 2004, 2005-ish, Lifetime wasn't necessarily having main gay characters in their movies and that sort of thing. And they were like, look, I wonder if we could make alternate versions. And I made two films for them that had a quote unquote straight version that was sold to Lifetime and a gay version that played on their gay network. And so I made a film called Deadly Skies, which was an asteroid about to destroy Earth movie. And there was sort of a Mission Impossible team that had to break into an installation to fire up this gigantic laser that was going to shoot down the asteroid and save the world. Okay, so in one version, on this little Mission Impossible team was Antonio Sabato Jr., who of course now is, I had no idea at the time that he was about his politics. Now he's a Trump supporter.
Oh no.
But at the time, it was very lovely working with him. And in one version, he had a romance going on with Radon Chong for the Lifetime version, mm-hmm. who, and she was part of this Mission Impossible team. In the gay version, he was having a romantic relations with one of the guys on the team. And for so just a few scenes had alternate versions. And we actually, for the gay network, we actually had a very hot sex scene between Antonio Sabato Jr. and this guy. And Antonio did, you see bare butt. With the other guy, you saw full frontal nudity. And so that was, you know, quite racy for its day. And in the Lifetime version, we didn't really have any nudity between Antonio and Radon Chong, but their romance developed, but it was much more of a PG-13 kind of romance. And so we had these two different versions. And the gay version ended up being called Force of Impact, which I always thought was a really kind of tongue-in-cheek innuendo title. Mm-hmm. And then Deadly Skies was what it was called, the straight version. And then we did a Christmas movie this way. But this was, of course, very family-oriented in both versions. In one, the story was a teenage girl spending too much time at the mall, and she befriends the mall Santa, and she tells him, "You're too fat, and you're too old-fashioned, and I'm going to put you through a makeover." And she puts him on a diet, and she cuts all of his hair off and shaves his beard and puts him in a tanning booth. And he comes out looking exactly like George Hamilton in a business suit because he's being played by George Hamilton in a business suit. Okay. And in the straight version, she has a mom and a dad. And in the gay version, she has two dads. So the way we did it, anytime we had a domestic scene at home, we would shoot with the mom and the dad, we'd shoot a take, and then we'd yank the mom out of the frame, and we'd put in the alternate other dad, and the other dad, the straight dad, also played one of the gay dads, and we would just do another take. And the production company said, "Now, Sam, because you're gay, you know, you just rewrite the dialogue, you know, however you think the gay fathers would be." And I'm like, "No, it should be exactly the same. There shouldn't be anything different about it. That's the beauty of this." The one thing we had not counted on is that the mall security guy comes to lecture the parents about how their daughter is spending too much time at the mall. And so we do the straight version, and he's like, "Mr. and Mrs. Smith, your daughter is spending too much time at the mall." Okay, we finish that scene, yank the mom out, put the other guy in, and then action. "Now, Mr. Smith, your daughter has been spending too much money at the mall." It was the only thing we hadn't addressed was how he was going to address them. And he just kind of stumbled and stuttered through it, which was perfect. And the whole, when we yelled cut, the whole crew and cast and everybody cracked up laughing because it was such a natural and funny way to do it. And we kept it in the film, and it was just perfect. It was great.
How did gay audiences respond to having these movies that felt like they were actually made for them?
They loved it. I mean, it was really great. And, you know, I mean, you look back on it now and it's kind of a little creepy that, you know, the mainstream networks couldn't have even accepted two dads in this Christmas movie. And nowadays, you know, with Hallmark and with Lifetime, they're pledging to have more LGBTQ representation, which is fantastic. But, you know, here we are in 2000, and this was, you know, over 15 years ago. So you can see how long it's taken to just kind of break through, you know, those barriers. And nowadays, I direct all the time for Hallmark and for Lifetime. I do tons of thrillers for Lifetime and tons of Christmas movies for Hallmark. So I'm kind of in the middle of it and, you know, seeing how, you know, how we can fit in gay characters and get away with it. And it's a slow process, but, you know, we're making headway. And then that's the good part. If we were going backwards, it'd be another thing, but at least it's progressing and moving forward.
Hmm. Do you have projects in the works that you're excited about or something like a dream project that you'd love to get going on?
I am supposed to do a Hallmark romance. This pandemic has kind of put the brakes on production and things are just starting to get going again. And we'll see, you know, how quickly that'll start up in the fall. I do want to backtrack, though, and tell you about one dream project that I did called Elvira's Haunted Hills.
Oh, yeah.
And that was done almost 20 years ago now. It's just so crazy. It's been that long. But that was a horror spoof that was spoofing the Vincent Price, Edgar Allan Poe, Roger Corman movies of the 60s, like Pit and the Pendulum and House of Usher and all of those great films. And I was such a huge fan of those as well. And when Cassandra Peterson, who's Elvira, she had seen my first feature film, Guilty as Charged, and loved it. I met her at a party. She said, if I ever do another film, I want you to direct it. And I was like, yeah, right. A few years go by, I get a call from her and she said, well, honestly, we are considering a number of other directors, but I always promised you that I want to at least give you a shot. Come in and meet with us. So I went in, she hands me the script, tells me that it's going to be a spoof of those Vincent Price movies. And she said, are you familiar with those? And I'm like, honey, am I familiar? This is Vincent Price, a climax of Pit and the Pendulum, his monologue. Do You Know Where You Are by Ptolemy? You are about to enter hell. Hell, the Neverworld, the infernal region, the abode of the damned, a place of torment, Gehenna, Nepraka, the pit, and the pendulum, the razor edge of destiny, thus the condition of man, bound on an island from which he can never hope to escape, surrounded by the waiting pit of hell, which must destroy him finally. And she cocked her head, looked at me like I was absolutely nuts, and said, you're hired. And I had actually learned that monologue in school, in like junior high school for an acting assignment where they said, you know, learn something like a Shakespeare monologue. And I was like, oh God, I don't want to do that. And I was like, and I raised my hand and I said, could I do Edgar Allan Poe? And that sounded academic enough. So I ran home and I used to tape films. This is before video or anything. I would tape the audio off of TV on little reel-to-reel tapes. And I had Pit and the Pendulum on a reel-to-reel tape. I transcribed that entire monologue. It wasn't written by Edgar Allan Poe. It was written by the screenwriter, Richard Matheson. But I wasn't about to tell my teachers that. And I learned it and went in and did it and got an A. And it just is stuck with me to this very day. I swear to God, I wasn't reading that. And it got me the job, you know. So again, it was just like these sort of charmed things that took a while to work themselves into alignment, but they paid off in the end. And we made that film in Romania and built the set like you wouldn't believe, the dungeons and just incredible. It was very low budget, but there money went so far we could build just incredible elaborate sets and we did it all. It was just so much fun. And it also had Richard O'Brien from Rocky Horror Picture Show, I idolize. He not only played Riff Raff in Rocky Horror, but he wrote Rocky Horror, the play, the screenplay, the music, and the lyrics. So, I mean, he's Mr. Rocky Horror, and he was brilliant. He was so, so good.
Wow. That is, what an amazing experience. And I am delighted that Elvira, you know, came up here. She's such an important part of, I've spoken to other creatives and other just guests who have been inspired by her. And even though she is, I don't think herself queer, I know that she was, you know, trained by drag performers in Las Vegas, and she's just had such a huge impact on so many gay men's lives.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she, you know, Elvira is kind of a drag queen when you really think about it. And it's the first movie, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, although I didn't have anything to do with it, I was always a huge fan of it. And again, she is an outsider. She's, you know, in that movie, she's, you know, going across country to take her show to Vegas. And she's confronting all the quote unquote normal people in society. And you know, is very, very much that same outsider thing. RuPaul considers Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, one of his top 10 favorite movies of all time. And he has, you know, Cassandra come as Elvira to be guest judge all the time on RuPaul's Drag Race. And drag queens and, you know, all gay men just idolize Elvira, and they identify with her in a really profound way.
So what is your, you said that production is just getting started again. Do you have, like, looking ahead, like stuff that you're excited to work on, or do you have like little projects that are just kind of like, I don't know, personal projects that are kind of moving along?
I do. There's a couple of things. One is, one of the Frankenstein films that I didn't talk about was a 1973 two-part NBC miniseries called Frankenstein, The True Story. And it had an all-star cast from James Mason, Agnes Moorhead, Sir Ralph Richardson, Sir John Gielgud, Michael Sarrazin played the creature, Leonard Whiting, who had played Romeo in the Zeffirelli version, played Dr. Frankenstein, David McCallum, just incredible production. Well, I saw that in 1973 when I was 17 years old. Now I'm really, you know, starting to become very aware of my closeted gay self. The whole movie from beginning to end screamed gay subtext to me. And I wasn't sure if I was reading more into it than there really was or not, but to me, it was gay from the word go. So I put it on the cover of my fanzine, which I was still doing at the time. And I interviewed some people like Jane Seymour when I went to London and stuff who had been in it. She plays the female creature. And I, you know, did a bit of a study in that fanzine. Of course, I didn't touch on the gay stuff because I was still closeted and I didn't want to raise any red flags. But as years went on, I kept seeing it again and again. And I'm like, this is so gay. I just can't believe it even got on primetime TV. Well, I find out that the screenwriters were Christopher Isherwood and Don Bacardi, legendary gay couple. Christopher Isherwood wrote the book that Cabaret was based on. He wrote A Single Man. And Don Bacardi is a world famous portrait artist. And they were very famous gay couple. And there's been a couple of documentaries about them. And they wrote it. And then I interviewed Don Bacardi, who's still alive. And I started gathering information, you know, about how gay it was. And the producer was gay, Hans Stromberg Jr. He discovered Vampyra, the very first horror host in the 50s, and created her show, her hosting show. He ended up being head of programming for CBS and created shows like The Munsters, and cast his friend Yvonne DiCarlo as Lily Munster and put the two white streaks in her hair because his favorite film of all time was The Bride of Frankenstein. Hello. Mm. And all these weird connections. And so this magazine called Little Shop of Horrors, you know, a very serious film magazine devoted to horror films. I knew the editor of that. He said, listen, I want you to come and do a whole study of Frankenstein, The True Story. And I'm like, oh my God, this would be fantastic, but it's going to take the whole issue. And he said, he just gave me the keys to the castle. I guest edited the entire issue, 120 pages. This was 3 years ago. And I got Anne Rice to write the foreword because Frankenstein, The True Story was the film that inspired her to write Interview with the Vampire. And it's one of her favorite films of all time. And I interviewed everybody that was still alive from Jane Seymour on down. And I won the Rondo Award for Best Article of the Year for the whole making of. And that magazine is the pride and joy of my life. And it led to me being hired to do all of the extras for the new Blu-ray of Frankenstein, The True Story that just came out this year from Shout Factory. And on that, I do, the movie's 3 hours because it was a two-part miniseries and you take the commercials out and it's 3 hours. And I do the three-hour commentary. I do on-camera interviews with Don Bacardi, with Leonard Whiting. I went over to London and got him. He played Dr. Frankenstein. And then I did Jane Seymour again. And so, I'm so proud of that. And it came out just in March, just as the shutdown was happening for the pandemic. So it was kind of crazy timing, but everybody's at home and needs to watch something. So you should definitely order it on Amazon. but just be sure it's the Blu-ray of Frankenstein, the True Story. So that I'm really excited about. And now I'm expanding that into a full-fledged book. And it's just been my crusade to kind of reclaim that as a, as the gay film that it was meant to be. The other thing that I did during the shutdown is I had to have some kind of creative outlet. And so I wrote a children's book. It's a, you know, the little golden books that we all had as kids. Mm-hmm. Well, this is in that style, and it's called Sam's Toilet Paper Caper. And it is based on my real life quest to find toilet paper when there was the pandemic paper panic, where there was no toilet paper at any of the stores. So I wrote this little story, and I got this incredible illustrator, and is just did the funniest drawings, and it's all about me trying to get toilet paper. We have all kinds of film references. There's from Carrie to Sound of Music to Good, Bad, and the Ugly, and we made the grocery store clerk Peter Lorre, and I mean it's the most fun book you're ever going to read, and you have to have a copy of it in your bathroom. Every bathroom needs one. Now, here's the good news. All the profits I'm donating to the World Health Organization's COVID-19 Solidarity Response Fund. And the book is only $10, and you can get the paperback version on Amazon. And so I highly, highly, highly recommend that. It was so much fun to do, and it's been a real hoot. And actually Elvira, or Cassandra Peterson, I got her to give me a quote for the back cover, as Elvira. And she said, "I laughed, I cried, I flushed."
Great.
So I'm promoting that now, obviously. And so that's what I've been doing during the shutdown.
With all the work that you've done in the horror genre, you know, a question that's come up on the show a lot, and I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on this. Why is horror so gay?
Well, I mean, I hate to repeat myself, but I think it goes back to the outsider thing. In so many situations, the you can find characters that are outsiders. I think that we like to be frightened. We are the underdogs in real life, and we love to see underdogs in these films, you know, fighting against all odds to make it to the end and not get killed. And so I think there's that aspect to it. But certainly in the case of the Frankenstein film, certainly in the case of an Elvira film, there's a character that we can really identify with in a profound way.
Because they have been rejected in some way, or are themselves rejecting.
Or just they don't fit in. You know, they're out of the quote unquote norm, and you know, being misunderstood, and they're having to, you know, march to a beat of the beat of their own drum, you know, make it through, especially a character like Elvira. You know, she's not going to let anybody tell her how to act or change herself in any way. She's that character is going to be that character. And I think that's very empowering for all of us.
Yeah. Oh, very much. Yeah. To know that, you know, if you do feel like an outsider, there's other outsiders to be on the inside of the outside with.
That's right. Exactly. We can choose our own families.
Well, I just love hearing these stories of the folks that you've worked with and the projects that you've done. And thanks so much for opening up and sharing all these. And if folks want to see your work or to check out that book, where should they go?
They should go to Facebook. I'm on there, very accessible. Sam Irvin, IRVIN. Just check me out there.
Fantastic. Sam, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Sam for joining me. For my recommendation this week, I'd like to suggest you check out one of Christopher Lee's lesser-known roles, that of Mr. Midnight in the film The Return of Captain Invincible. Specifically, look for the musical number entitled Name Your Poison, one of the few very watchable moments from a film that doesn't otherwise urgently cry out for a full viewing. In that scene, Christopher Lee's character is tempting the hero of the movie to indulge his great weakness, alcohol, so that he will be unable to save the world from whatever Lee's evil scheme is. The story doesn't really matter as much as the earnest dedication that Lee throws into the part, as he does indeed with all parts, whether Dracula or Saruman or Count Dooku. There isn't a single frame where he isn't the most watchable thing on screen, completely commanding and dramatic despite the goofy lyrics. Christopher Lee was a man who could sell the most absurd material through sheer force of will, and the fact that he does it so expertly in so silly a movie is all the more reason to be impressed. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get some backer rewards. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com, and join us for the next live stream on September 19th at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link to that pinned to the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Check out my YouTube series Culture Cruise for detailed explorations of queer milestones from TV and film, and subscribe to my podcasts Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two comedy adventure shows featuring drag heroes in a world of fantasy. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.